It's the Troopany Show with your host, James Troopany.
Program. We're not going to look at Best of Super Juniors this week. We're going to save that for next week, or possibly the week after. Depends when it finishes and how much we get rewatched. But today, instead, we are going to celebrate the lifetimes and careers of the man with the worst personality in the world, Minoru Suzuki. And our beginner's guide to Japanese wrestling is coming up on Minoru's 30th anniversary in pro wrestling. We thought it was time for him to have a light shine on his career and to help me celebrate the great man himself. I have Mr. Marcus Green of Total Wrestling. How are you, sir?
I'm good. Didn't expect to be talking about Minoru, as I usually stay away from him. Even as a viewer, I try to stay away from Minoru. But a great legendary guy, and going to be cool talking about him today.
And also joining me is Chelsea Spollen of ShouldersUp.net. How are you, Mom?
I'm doing okay. This is going to be fun, I think. Be a good show.
It should be. Now, Minoru Suzuki, as we know him today, he's nearly 50 years old. He still wrestles pretty much better than anyone else on the New Japan roster. He's still a vital guy. He's just come off an Intercontinental Championship run. He held the Never Openweight Championship. Before that, he was GHC Heavyweight Champion. Before that, he had another main event run in New Japan Pro Wrestling. He's done everything in modern day wrestling. He helped redefine what pro wrestling could be in the 1980s. And he was one of the major stars of the birth of MMA in Japan in the 1990s. Chelsea, what are your thoughts when it comes to Minoru Suzuki, and what do you think about this enigma of a man?
Well, what's kind of insane to me, just as reading about his career and then watching some stuff to prepare for this show, is, I mean, obviously, every pro wrestling fan who watches New Japan Pro Wrestling now knows about Minoru Suzuki, right? And he's one of those names that everybody's heard of, at least, even if you don't know him. But I don't know that I really realized how versatile his career has really been, or how diverse, I guess I should say. Like, watching matches that he had in 1994 when he was doing straight MMA is a completely different animal from watching matches he had in the early 2000s, where it's sort of like half wrestling, half MMA. And it's completely different from the stuff he does now. And he does all of it really, really well. Like, he always performs at such a high level, But he's done so many different things. It was really impressive when I was watching a whole bunch of stuff to get ready for this podcast, exactly how much this guy has done.
Yeah, I mean, he's an evolutionary animal. You know, the guy we see today, I was watching some Noah stuff that he did in the early 2000s, like you said, and he's wrestling Kenta Kobashi. I was watching that this morning, and like you A-B that against the stuff he's doing in New Japan now, and the moves are still the same, but the way he presents them are so different, and the fact that he's developed this character, it's like his character has slowly evolved, while his wrestling style is constantly changing to match up with, or to keep up with the people around him.
Yeah, it's really interesting too. Like, I've seen him get MMA matches out of guys that are pro wrestlers, and somehow it still seems to work, or watch him have grappling matches with guys who are pro wrestlers who don't have that kind of background, who, you know, where mat work isn't really their strong suit, and he can still make it look like a real match, and it gives it that big fight feel. It's really fascinating.
He's a fascinating character. Marcus, what are your thoughts on Minoru Suzuki?
Yeah, a lot of the same, I think. Piggyback off a lot of what Chelsea said. You know, just that evolution, you know, how he was obviously early in his days wrestling, you know, MMA, to his transition now, obviously, because it's a complete flip for me, because I got introduced to Minoru, obviously, in his latter years. But, you know, he was that kind of that cool, calm, collected guy, you know, in the Pancrase matches, to kind of just let his technique do the talking. Whereas now, like you said, James, his character is you know, kind of, you know, take center stage, but that technique is always still there. So, you know, again, I was not to compare the two, but just using that as a point of reference, kind of showed me, like, when I got introduced to Goldberg, and obviously he was known for his quick and short matches, and then you go back and watch some of his matches, like, hey, this guy can do submissions, and this guy is obviously far more skilled in other areas than what he's actually using and getting over with. And Minoru is just the guy who, you know, like you said, the guy with the worst personality in the world, but obviously is notoriously known for just giving zero fucks and just kind of letting stuff come to him. So, you know, that's kind of been a mainstay, but how he's kind of used that and how he approaches things is truly great. And also him collecting all those championships just as a prize to go along with the pain he's inflicted, you know, is been cool to watch too.
Yeah, I mean, he is such a character these days. He's like the character of Minoru Suzuki is really important to what New Japan Pro Wrestling's become, and you need that dark character. He's always going to be the biggest of big bads. He's never going to be a good guy. That's him. You know, that's part of what he's become and part of what he's become as a pro wrestler. Let's go back to the beginning, though, and it starts with his amateur wrestling career. He was an amateur wrestler in high school and was nearly made the Olympic team. He was nearly an alternate on the Olympic team, and it was the first time he met Yuji Nagata in 1986, who was obviously an amateur wrestler as well. Now, obviously, we know Yuji is today the head of the New Japan Dojo, and I find it interesting. You've got two characters there that one stayed in the same place and is now highly respected but at the bottom of the card, and the other guy, who's, you know, slightly older, has been everywhere and is still at the top of the card. That's interesting kind of juxtaposition between those two guys for me. Even though they've done just as much in the business, I think finding those two characters and A-Bing them together as they've literally done everything but separately, that's really interesting to me, and how the two people have forged their careers. So Minoru Suzuki starts training at the New Japan Dojo, and made his debut in 1988 wrestling Tayuki Iizuka. You know, the bald guy that beats up commentators in New Japan in Suzuki Gun? That guy. Yeah, him. It was that long ago, because Iizuki wasn't too far off of his rookie year either. But soon after he left with catch mentor Yoshiaki Fujiwara, he of the Fujiwara armbar, but of course he just calls it an armbar, and they became part of the second UWF. Now, if you go back to the early episodes in Beginner's Guide to Japan, we talked a lot about the first UWF and Satoru Sayama and Akira Maeda and their relationship with New Japan's pro wrestling and Antonio Inoki and breaking away. in the second go round of the UWF Reborn, Akira Maeda was on his own and he was booking by himself. And they brought in talent from the New Japan dojo. Now, Yoshiyuki Fujiwara had been running the dojo, and Suzuki was his best student. And I believe Maeda bought out the contracts of both of them from New Japan Pro Wrestling so he could have them on their roster, which shows how much he believed in them to be future stars and important to the training schedules of these two, this particular company. Now, Chelsea, you've done a lot of work with me on the shoot revolution in New Japan, in Japanese wrestling. What do you think that relationship between Fujiwara and Suzuki and Maeda and Suzuki is like, and how do you think it reflects on the business practice here?
Oh, man. Well, I don't know about their interpersonal relationship necessarily, but I think it's really interesting to me watching early stuff from Minoru Suzuki's career, because a lot of his early fights that are MMA are, they look more like wrestling to me than they do MMA fights. Does that make sense?
Yeah, like, it does, yeah.
My standard for what MMA looks like in my head, for the most part, is basically like UFC, you know, or I think I've watched a couple Bellator specials, but I'm used to a really fast pace of MMA where it really looks like two people are trying to kill each other. And it's interesting that Pancrase, to me, kind of looks more like shoot wrestling. It looks more like half fiction, half, okay, we're going to do this because it actually looks really good and we can tell a story with it. It's also, I guess it's interesting, I didn't know prior to researching for this podcast that he had this, that sort of mentor-student relationship with Fujiwara, but it makes a lot of sense because I think of Fujiwara as a guy whose pro wrestling matches, even when he's doing something that's, if you really think about it, you're like, okay, that's not really a fighting move you could use to take somebody down in combat. His matches usually look very realistic. You know, you believe them when you're watching. You believe who wins and you believe who loses. And that's something Minoru Suzuki is definitely like. I mean, I've watched him do some stuff in New Japan recently where if you really think about it, you're not going to be able to suspend your disbelief. But while you're watching it as it's happening, you don't question it. You just kind of live in the moment of it. I don't know. It makes sense to me that I think, I don't know how to articulate it. It makes sense to me that Minoru Suzuki is part of that, this particular wave of that wrestling tradition. Although that wasn't something that I had in my head prior to researching this for this podcast. Like I never thought of him that way. It just kind of made, like, I just think of him as like the scary guy who shows up and beats people up with chairs and chases them around the arena. And, you know, we joke about him being the murder dad. But he's murder dad in another sense too, and then he was like one of the fathers of this particular style of wrestling, which is really cool.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, it is, I'm sure Marcus could actually probably put more light on it than me, because I've kind of known him throughout his career. So Marcus, you've known him as Murder Dad Minoru Suzuki. Going back and watching his early days in UWF and PWFG, what is the difference between those two entities of Suzuki?
I mean, really, it's kind of just a foundation to be that crazy, you know, murder dad. You know, like Joseph said, you wouldn't expect him to, you know, have that inner connection with somebody in a mentor-mentee relationship. But it really makes sense, because now he comes off like somebody who's just a self-taught savage. But obviously that foundation came from somewhere. Obviously, you know, he was taught by, you know, the great Carl Gotch, and he used the pile driver and whatever. But, you know, you're talking about working with Fujiwara, and, you know, it kind of makes all the sense in the world. Obviously, you know, extremely great talent, but his whole thing is how, you know, he's perfected the technique of how to torture someone. Obviously now he just goes to the complete savage end of it and just blatantly tries to kill them. But, you know, going back and watching the Pancrase is very much breaking somebody down, you know, staying calm. It's a lot of forms of manipulation, both physically, mentally, and a lot of times emotionally. So, you know, taking that armbar was just a piece, you know, in that overall evolution. You know, as like I said, his whole thing is how to really break a human down and torture him. So I think it's kind of like a natural, you know, transition and like I said, just a piece in that foundation to get to this crazy murder dad who is no longer just starting off calm and then letting the work speak for him. He's going to kill you in just several different ways now.
Well, let's have a look at this section of his career and just give you a timeline. So he joins New Japan Pro Wrestling in 1988. He has his rookie year. He moves to UWF in late 1988. And UWF is a massive hit at the box office. They fill the Tokyo Dome within a year of their first matches. And Akira Maeda is on top of the world. But by the very nature of this particular wrestling style, they can't run shows on a weekly basis. So let's give you an example now. Like Noah, New Japan, All Japan, they do 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off. They have a rotation of main events that everyone gets rested. And most of the time, you're in tag matches. Now, don't get me wrong. That is an incredibly tough schedule. It's one of the toughest schedules in pro wrestling. However, UWF is full-on contact. Now, the matches in UWF and PWFG weren't shoot matches. They were not real contests. But the matches up until the finish were a real contest. They did hit each other correctly and hard. They did use true submission techniques. But until they got up to the run-up to the finish, they were always shooting, so it was always a full-on physical contest until they got to the end of the matches. Now, the reason for that is because promoters do not like unpredictable things happening, so they still booked the ending of the matches because promoters want to book controllable programs, even in a completely sports context. These companies looked very, very different to what WWE or even New Japan or even All Japan today look like. These were no angles. There was an event, you put one wrestler up against another wrestler, and that's what sold the tickets. It was as old school as pro wrestling got. Now, that wasn't to say it wasn't gimmick-free. For instance, Nobuhiko Takada in UWFI fought Trevor Burbick in one of the worst matches of all time that lasted about 11 seconds till Trevor decided he wasn't going to get kicked in the face because that wasn't part of the rules, and bailed on the event, and there was a riot. But generally speaking, this was a sports-based orientated product. Now, PWFG was the company that Minoru went to next with his mentor, Yoshiaki Fujiwara. Meanwhile, the rest of the UWF roster went on to form UWFI, including some people we'll talk about later on in this show. But PWFG, me and Chelsea did a review of one of their shows not long ago, and I think you said at the time it looked more like what MMA would become rather than... Well, no, UWFI... to you look more like what MMA would become, and this looked more like a traditional pro wrestling show, I think you said at the time.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah, so it's much more, it's less striking, though there's plenty of kicking and hand strikes going on as you'd expect in this era, but it's much more of a traditional wrestling product. I think there was one point, Ken Shamrock, I can't remember who was wrestling, but he actually does a Northern Light suplex on somebody and then rolls through with it to get a grovet onto them, which is kind of a mix of pro wrestling, but in pro wrestling, the other person will do a forward flip to help you through the Northern Light suplex, whereas Ken just powered the guy over. Because Ken Shamrock was ridiculously strong, and I'll talk about Ken Shamrock in a second. So this is much more kind of like what amateur wrestling would be with some professional polish, I guess is a good way of describing it, isn't it?
Yeah, actually. And it's really interesting because I was just thinking while I was listening to you talk about that, James, I was thinking about how I feel like right now in modern American wrestling, WWE is kind of fixing their sights on how do they integrate MMA style pro wrestling into their product. And it's kind of interesting how it like moves cyclically back around. You know, it keeps coming back. It's like I think a lot of MMA fans talk about MMA like it's this thing that's totally separate from pro wrestling because it's real and wrestling is fake. And I just don't think you'd have the modern iterations of either of those two things without both.
No, you wouldn't. I mean, like, as an example, I will use this as an example now. Ken Shamrock, who is in the UFC Hall of Fame, one of the greatest shoot fighters that ever lived, started his life as a pro wrestler, went to the Malenko School, and he saw a videotape of PWFG, and he wanted to go wrestle in that promotion. And their booker happened to be at the Malenko School, And he said, well, show me what you can do. And there was a couple of PWFG fighters who were training there. And Ken managed to keep them down. He managed to wrestle with them for 20 minutes and he beat them in a straight up shoot fight. And then they shipped
without
him.
Actual martial arts experience.
No. Yeah, because he was a street fighter and he was a tough kid. He'd won tough man contests. He could wrestle because he'd wrestled in high school. And they went, okay then. So they sent him to Japan and they had a couple of young boys in the dojo and he held them down for 20 minutes. He kind of beat up on them for 20 minutes. And then Minoru Suzuki and Funaki walk in. And they say, do you want to keep going? And it's like, yes, of course, because you don't give up because you want the job. So Ken kept going and he said Suzuki wrestled him for about 20 minutes and ran rings around for him 20 minutes, but he would not quit and he would not give up. And that's when they gave him the job. You know, this even PWFG, you had to be that tough to get in the ring. You know, you couldn't just be a standard worker. There was guys like Jerry Flynn as well who were American stars who ended up in PWFG. It was a very different kind of style of wrestling, but it was still pro wrestling and the people they were attracting were pro wrestlers. And then when PWFG gets established, it starts going well, but again, you've got this problem of the fact that you can't hold too many events, which is the problem UWF had, because your wrestlers can't keep up that pace for that many times. You can't do 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, because it would just kill everybody. So they're starting to try and use gimmicks to try and increase their popularity, and Fujiwara starts relying on a lot of lucha ideas and a lot of lucha presentation, and the roster don't like it. So they break away from PWFG and form Pancras. And that's the basis of where things start. So, Marcus, what were your, as usually the first one to look at Pancras this week as something completely new, what's your kind of impressions of Pancras as a company?
I thought it was really cool and you know, kudos to those guys for, you know, breaking away. Obviously, Lucha, you know, not to take anything away from them, but a lot of times when you're watching that, like when I'm watching, like, you know, some of those guys on 205 Live or things on Lucha Underground, what have you, a lot of times it's kind of hard to suspend your disbelief when you can literally see, you know, from start to finish the setup to how something has to go with a lot of those moves. And with, you know, watching Pancras, it's kind of just, you know, it's like how much we praise Zack Sabre Jr. It's just beautiful watching how somebody can transition from one move and go to the next. And, you know, Suzuki, you know, was really a master of it. And to go with what Chelsea was saying, it's kind of, you know, crazy how you see the evolution of, you know, obviously what MMA to wrestling today, because our perception of UFC is, like Chelsea said, it's kind of like, you know, beating a guy up if you know, have him in a submission or a certain guard. So it was kind of weird for me watching Pancras and seeing somebody like Suzuki have somebody down and a guy not trying to, like, do a hammer fist to his head. I'm not used to that.
Yeah, yeah.
So you know, it was kind of like fish out of water, but it made it, you know, more fascinating to watch, because then you get more methodical on how you escape something like that, or watching somebody's frustration. Because if, you know, you find somebody like Suzuki, like I said, he's staying calm through everything. And a lot of times Suzuki was smaller than a lot of his opponents. So being able to control them was even more important and even more frustrating to them. So naturally, you would probably want to hit him in the head, which, you know, like you said, kind of something that kind of evolved and what we now get with UFC. So it was just really cool just watching just truly how methodical that type of technique is, as opposed to, and like I said, not to disrespect anything with Lucha, but it's just so many more facets to taking control when it comes to that shoot style.
Yeah, just to give you a kind of like a wider picture of what Pancras was about. Pancras started off was going to be just another wrestling promotion, but Carl Gotch, in conversations with Ken Shamrock and Minoru Suzuki and Matsunaki Funaki, said, well, why does it have to be a booked wrestling promotion? Why can't we do this for real? Because Carl Gotch had come in as a trainer, as they didn't no longer had Fujiwara as a mentor. Carl Gotch, and we've talked about Carl Gotch before, and his how can I put it, his inspiration behind New Japan Pro Wrestling and what Strong Style would become, his inspiration behind the first UWF and what that was trying to achieve. Carl Gotch was very much in the forward seat of what pro wrestling would evolve into, because he always wanted to move the art form forward to the point of, you know, he got blackballed in a lot of places because of his attitude towards pro wrestling and trying to move the art form forward. You know, he'd been to Wigan and he wasn't that popular there when he left. He was not that popular in North America. In fact, Buddy Rogers had him blackballed in North America. He ended up in Japan because no one else would have him. But he finds this home in this idea of shoot style wrestling. Now, the promotion used the basic rules of pro wrestling and what you see in pro wrestling as the basis for Pancras and that rule set. So you had strikes, you had no closed fists, you could still use the ropes to break, and it became about submissions and knockouts, no longer about pinfalls. Chelsea, what are your first impressions of this company? Now you've kind of like seen Suzuki grow and you've watched PWFG and UWF and seen the evolution. Do you think it kind of predicted where MMA would go, or did you see it as a jumping off point, or what did you feel about the presentation?
So, I don't know. It's interesting. I think one of the first things that stood out to me is that every Pancras match I watched feels very short.
Yes.
You know, it's, which is similar to, I think, how UFC is now. It's also interesting that because it's kind of presented like a wrestling product, right? It feels different from how an MMA product is usually presented. I don't know that I can totally put my finger on it. I think part of it is because it's in a wrestling ring. But, you know, even though it's presented like a wrestling product, the thing that captures your attention that makes you want to watch a fight is really kind of staked pretty much just on the reputation and charisma of the performers themselves, because like you kind of said before, there's no storytelling leading up to it. It's not like there's somebody gets on a microphone and cuts a promo about, I'm going to beat the crap out of you, and the other guy does something, you know, like there's none of that. It's just like, hey, these two guys are going to fight, and they do. It's interesting that people would show up for matches like that, considering how short they were.
Yeah.
And considering that, you know, it must have been people who were really enjoying some kind of genuine competitive aspect of it rather than the storytelling aspect of it. Which is, I don't know, it's funny. When I was watching Pancras matches, one of the ones I found was Minoru Suzuki and Jushin Thunder Liger.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was really surprised because, I mean, Liger was, like, in trunks. I'm used to seeing him in the full body suit. And, I mean, he still had a mask on. But he throws a punch at Minoru Suzuki, and Minoru Suzuki takes him down. At one point, he does a flip in the air, and the crowd goes, oh, you know, there's a big audible gasp moment, and he pays for that when he ends up on the ground, and Minoru gets his guard open. It's very interesting to me because it's an MMA product that doesn't dismiss pro wrestling, that, like, kind of knows that those are the foundations of where it came from, but it's still trying to tell you stories that are genuine actual fights. I don't know that I've ever really seen anything exactly like that before.
No, I agree with you. And the time thing really does fascinate me, because, like, I think the first main event of a Pancras show went 15 seconds. And it,
wow.
And it blew everybody's minds, you know, because they were used to even UWF, which was a booked show, the main event's going to go 20 minutes, you know, and there's going to be, you're going to tell a story in those 20 minutes. Whereas this was, the story is this guy got an armbar on, that's it. You know, so, and as well, Suzuki becomes like, he was that good as a combat wrestler, as a true fighter. You know, he starts carrying guys. I think you mentioned it earlier, Chelsea, when you were saying, looking back at the videos, like guys who were not as good as he was able to carry them to decent
yes.
fights, even in a shoot fight scenario. Shamrock was
Which,
the
like,
same,
how do you,
so was Finaki.
How do you do that?
They were just that good. There's an example of this, the story. I was watching an interview with Josh Barnett, who's the commentator for New Japan Pro Wrestling, and they were doing sparring sessions, and he was doing a sparring session with Minoru Suzuki, and all Minoru did was tie up his ankles. He put his shin bone on Josh's ankles. And he had this technique for keeping him down, and Josh couldn't figure out how to get out of it. And this is Josh Barnett, one of the greatest mixed martial artists of all time, a former UFC champion. And Minoru tied him in knots. And he said, I've got to get him back to show him how he did it. And this is like, this was when Josh was at his peak and Minoru had kind of moved away from competitive fighting. You know, he's so smart. He's such a good fighter. And these matches were just incredible. And you could see as well, because they didn't just rely on him to be a major draw. They had Funaki and Shamrock and a few other people as well. But, you know, it does become about these characters, because there's not an awful lot else to draw there, is there?
Yeah, I mean, the charisma of the performers is probably a thing that holds a lot of those matches together. You know, like, some of the guys Minoru had matches with, I'm watching them and I'm like, I don't know who that guy is, but there's clearly something interesting about him. And then, you know, the match will last, like, 30 seconds. And maybe the thing that's interesting sometimes is, like, their determination, because Suzuki is always really scary. Like, he comes across as so intimidating. That particular thing about him hasn't changed.
Yeah, no, he's that character. How would you, Marcus, how would you describe the Minoru Suzuki character in Pancras, if there is such a thing? Because obviously it's just Minoru Suzuki, but yeah, how would you
really
describe him?
At that point, even more, seems like obviously a toned down Minoru Suzuki, but just listening to you guys go back and forth about it, it's really, you know, for me, like a real stark contrast. And obviously, you know, growing up on WWE and now looking at New Japan as I've gotten older and wiser, you know, really it's just giving you realism through simple reality. Like you said, the things that are happening when you're watching a Pancras match is reality, because that stuff hurts, pure and simple. There is no, you know, pomp and circumstance around everything. You know, I was watching one of those matches with Suzuki, and, you know, obviously he was going for an armbar, and the guy was so focused on getting his guard, keeping his guard, and, you know, locking his arms together, that, you know, Suzuki easily transitioned into like a really brutal, crooked head scissors lock.
Yeah.
And almost snapped the guy's neck off. And it's like, you don't need to put any more salt on the grits. That's it. You know, he was about to get his neck snapped off and he tapped. Whereas, you know, you watch something like WWE and they're trying to, you know, Vince's way is trying to use this thing of wrestling to, you know, promote some type of realism, but really just trying to put the focus on this pure entertainment value. So whereas the focus of a simple Pancras match is clearly that hurt and that was the end of it because he was about to get his neck snapped off. And they'll do the pomp and circumstance, and like Chelsea said, do a promo, and then they get into the match. And not to take away anything from these guys' skill sets, but, you know, they'll center around like the biggest part of the match to be reversing the figure four, which doesn't exist because that's not a real thing.
No.
As we know, oh my God, he reversed the figure four. He switched up the pain. That doesn't exist. So I think, you know, with Suzuki, you watching, you know, to get back to the evolution of his character in Japan, you know, those guys are just taken far more seriously because the art form is presented as such that, you know, you're never questioning these guys being tough.
No.
So, you know, there's so much more room and creativity later for them to do character work because obviously the work is there. You know these guys are tough because you see, you know, the technique and just how forceful they are when they put in the work with the moves. So now somebody like Suzuki could just transition and be like, have the creative freedom to really play with his character because he literally has everything else in the bag. Whereas in America, it's like, you know, these guys always have their credibility questioned as tough guys because it's so much entertainment value put on this real art form that doesn't need anything else really put on top of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, the character of Minoru Suzuki kind of starts in this time period as well. I mean, he starts where everyone else in Pancras kind of still comes to the ring in a ring robe, which is a very traditional kind of wrestling deal, whereas he comes to the ring with a towel over his head. Now, we know that move now because he still does that today. It's the same thing he was doing back then. But he does take on all sorts of challenges in this particular career. He takes on boxer versus wrestler matches. Maurice Smith, who was a very handy kickboxer in that time period, who appeared in UFC 2, I think, and I think he won UFC 3. He fought him. I watched that match this morning. Minoru wasn't great for the strikes, but he was great for grappling. And also, you're right, I love the fact that he won a match with a head scissors. It was a crooked head scissors, which was invented in Wigan. You know?
Yeah.
It's an old shoot style match from the guys in the snake pit. They were the guys who developed that maneuver. And it was... It's interesting to me, like, how much of the stuff I watched when I was a kid is in Minoru Suzuki's moveset, because those old Wigan guys who taught a lot of the British wrestlers what they were doing, because the northern British wrestlers came from that tradition, filtered down through Billy Robinson and Carl Gotch into what Minoru Suzuki and Ken Shamrock and Maxinati, I can never pronounce his first name, Funaki were doing, and it makes for this incredible, as they say, hybrid style of wrestling mixed with striking. Did you guys watch the hybrid documentary by any chance?
I don't think so, no.
You can find it on YouTube. But actually, if you go on a playlist, I put a playlist together on YouTube of, if you go to the Troopany Show YouTube page, you can find a Minoru Suzuki playlist. And on there is a documentary series about Pancras in the early days of Pancras, and it shows you everything they do in the run-up to matches, all their training, and the training is brutal. Like,
I believe it.
Yeah, you know, hanging pull-ups where you put the clamps on your bar on your ankles and then flip onto the bar and do that. They do that, but they don't have the clamps. They just hang by their feet. It's insane.
That kind of reminds me a little bit of the training regimen from the Gaia documentary.
Yeah, very much so.
Everything they had to learn to do to condition themselves was stuff you can do with your own body without a weight room.
Yeah, yeah. Everything. I mean, they do lift a lot of weights, and there's a lot of talk about shoulder development because of the... Obviously, if you're going for cross-arm locks all the time, you want arms that are ridiculously strong to counter that. So that's the reason why these guys have such big body mass. But also, they're the first guys I saw with the kind of body shape that's pretty popular in pro wrestling now, the kind of body shape that Finn Balor has, that very lean look, lean down, stripped down. In fact, Minoru Suzuki doesn't have that look anymore, and that's probably to do with the fact as he got older and injuries started to build up, it was better to have some padding around him rather than take bumps on straight onto muscle. So, you know, they were the first guys to have that lean, stripped down look, what we kind of expect a modern wrestler to look like Will Ospreay looks like Kushida looks like to an extent. You know, they were built like that as opposed to built like in a traditional heavy, thick set, squat kind of wrestler kind of way.
That's interesting. And when you were talking about that, it kind of, for some reason, because obviously, like I said, I didn't get a chance to catch that, but I would imagine it's brutal. You know, to be able, like I said, just the sheer technique and thought process that goes into just, you know, preparing for one of those matches and what you have to do during it. But it kind of reminded me because I was watching like a UFC training camp or whatever, and it reminds me of the exercise. I forgot the exact name, but when they have somebody like a bad luck Fale, say, stand there, and then they have a partner, like somebody like Finn Balor, just like crawl on them for like 20 minutes until they can't go anymore. just crawl around their body and have the guy stand there. It's like an endurance exercise and something else. But that kind of reminds me of what we get, like you said, on the ground when a guy's riding someone and then making those transitions, kind of spider-like almost. So I would imagine only what else they have to, you know, do to stay in shape for that. Because obviously you need a strong core and obviously great hand strength for wrist locking, arm lock control and all that. So I would imagine it's brutal.
Yeah, just is brutal. Now, if you've ever played Tekken, you may have also seen Minoru Suzuki wrestle. Because in this time period, he actually becomes the, what's the phrase there? I've got it written down here. I can't remember what it's called.
Motion capture.
There you go, motion capture. He becomes the motion capture actor for the character King, who was actually based on Tiger Mask, which is a bit of a weird kind of crossover. But there you go. But again, Satoru...
And he physically doesn't look like either of those guys, which is really interesting. But once I found that out, I realized he moves like them.
Yes, he does. It is really strange, isn't it? Because I haven't played Tekken in a while, but I'm going to have to go find an emulator for Tekken, because I don't think I've got anything I can play Tekken on at the moment. I'm sure I can find one on the internet somewhere.
I think one of his finishers is basically a Tiger Bomb.
Yes. Yeah, it will be. Because there was a couple of games in that time period, especially the Japanese-based games, that used one of the characters, and one of them was called Dynamite Tommy, which obviously is based on the Dynamite Kid, Tommy Billington. So... Yeah, it was interesting how gamers who got influenced by pro wrestling in the 80s and 90s and kind of filtered it into their fight games. Now, over the 10-year period, Pancras kind of became much bigger and bigger and kind of more came closer and closer to what MMA looks like today. But Minoru Suzuki kept going through this time period. He becomes the king of Pancras at one point. But generally speaking, his body begins to break down and he realizes that he can't keep up a full schedule of shoot fighting. Towards the end of his Pancras run, he becomes much more involved in grappling fights with no striking involved to give his body a rest and a chance to still be competitive. But into the early 2000s, he decides it's time to give shoot fighting a rest and go back to being a pro wrestler. And as such, he signs on with New Japan Pro Wrestling as a freelancer. He has a run there. He has a run in Noah. He does win the AWGP Tag Team Championship with his old friend Yoshihiro Takayama, who was in the UWF with him. And then he begins his first extended run in 2006 in All Japan Pro Wrestling, turning up to challenge for the Triple Crown. And really, the start of the character that we know Minoru Suzuki as today. He starts a long-standing feud with Kojima, and this All Japan run becomes kind of a signature period for him, where he kind of like finds his feet as a pro wrestler. So what do you think of this particular period, Chelsea, of Minoru Suzuki trying to evolve himself yet again?
So it's really interesting because when Minoru Suzuki slows down to give himself a chance to be in matches where... Sorry, let me start again. It's interesting because when he starts to slow down as an MMA fighter and he gets back into pro wrestling, his matches become so much more interesting to me personally. That guy has such a presence about him that can really lend itself well to telling a story. And it's nice watching those All Japan matches to see this guy who, you know, I've been watching a bunch of the Pancras stuff leading up to it, where, you know, I know he's really talented and I know he's really interesting, but a lot of his matches were so short. And then suddenly seeing him have like a 15-minute match, a 20-minute match, where he's still doing really interesting, really intricate looking things, but it's weirdly less violent and more fun. To me, that was really refreshing. I really enjoyed that. I kind of get the sense actually that when he started in All Japan, because I watched 2-3 matches from right at the beginning of that period, I kind of get the sense that he was enjoying himself more than he was at the end of his career at Pancras, because his matches look like they're more fun. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I can agree with that. Yeah.
You know, I think that his character has been so consistent throughout his career, but it's really interesting that his style has evolved so much through that. Like, the thing that I think he does, it's not like he subtracted any of the viciousness of his character. You know, he's still hyper competitive. He's still gonna make sure you pay for it if you land any blows on him. But I don't know how to describe it. Like, the matches are less violent, but they're still really, really intense. He never loses that intensity, even though he's doing stuff that's less physically demanding.
You never lose the sense of danger there, do you, with him?
Yeah. He's always very scary. You can tell a lot of his opponents, even in just a straight wrestling match, look nervous about wrestling with him. Or they get down into themselves like, okay, I have to steel myself for this because I'm about to get my ass kicked. Like, yeah. That's kind of always how people react to him. And he always deserves that reaction. It never feels forced.
Yeah, it reminded me of something Jim Ross said the other week on his show. He was retelling a story about the fact that he was at some meet and greet somewhere, and for the first time, Danny Hodge and Billy Robinson met each other. Despite the fact they're in, like, their early 70s, Billy's eyes never left Danny.
Wow.
Because they're both shooters, they're both badasses, and Billy never stopped looking at what Danny was doing. Pleasant, cordial, very nice to catch up, but, you know, because they're two gunslingers, and that's the kind of feeling you get with Minoru Suzuki. He is one of the most dangerous men that ever lived, as far as, like, combat sports is concerned, and he never loses that within his character. Marcus, how does that character kind of develop then through this run in All Japan Pro Wrestling? Do you feel that, and his run up to the modern day, do you feel that work he did in MMA enabled him to do this, or do you think he would have been able to do it without that MMA run first?
I think the MMA, I mean, I think if he hadn't gone through the MMA, you know, and again, kudos to anybody that is very much becomes aware of their body and through this incredible sport, you know, recognizes their limitations and it has the ability to scale back, but at the same time, like you and Chelsea said, keep that level of realism through, you know, that just endless aggression that he brings. I think with Minoru, you know, and getting back to Kid Shamrock for a minute, I think the only thing he was really missing in his game was an in-depth array of submissions. I don't think he was too and he himself talked about, you know, he kind of needed to up his submission game when he, you know, kind of delve in the pancreas and such. But, yeah, I think with Minoru, I think because of that pancreas and that style, you always kind of have to be on, and you know, even when you're in control and that, you're always doing something. It's not never really anything that's let up. You know, you don't really get a break physically or mentally. You always have to be thinking of, you know, not only what you're doing, but what your opponent is doing or what they can do should you, you know, not be doing this or don't do that. Or it's very, you know, mental chess. You know, and now seeing the transition, he's able to, you know, it's kind of what you can do in between the moves and, you know, or a simple throat chop, you know, which will create a level of separation and still give you that realism, like, you know, like you talked about. So I think, you know, hearing you guys talk about it and just how it kind of feels to be in there with somebody like Minoru, who still instills that fear of somebody who is going to take you through everything that you will go through a pancreas match, but doesn't, you know, just speaks to, you know, his intimidation factor. And I think, you know, it's scary to kind of think about that, because I can only imagine what goes through somebody's mind, you know, against somebody like a Zack Sabre Jr., who very much kind of still has that style of something's always going on. Whether you're attacking the guy or the guy's attacking you, you can't let up mentally or physically. It's just complete torture until that bell rings. So, you know, with Minoru, like I said, kudos to him for recognizing his body's limitations and being able to kind of downgrade his style but keep that fluid aggression in it. And I think with, you know, like you said, going back to your original question, James, I think it's kind of hard to say, because I just think there's nothing the man can't do, but I think that style, being able to push his body to where it did to kind of make him into that transition, I think it definitely helped.
Yeah, I mean, I'll talk about this in a little bit, but to me, he's a guy that just embraces the environment he's in all the time. You know, All Japan Wrestling is different to what New Japan Pro Wrestling is, and certainly very different to what Pancras was, or even the UWF or PWFG was about. You know, King's Road style, we've talked about it a lot before in this series, about, like, you know, it's about building moves together. And I was watching a match he had with Kenta Kobashi, which is in Noah, obviously, but it's still a King's Road style company. And those two styles he has meshes really well. That style that Minoru Suzuki has, that can adapt to the things that are going on around him to tell the story and get the best out of his opponent, at the same time highlighting what he can do really, really well. He adapts that so well to whatever situation he's in and wherever he's wrestling or whoever he's wrestling for. He knows exactly what to do to make things work the way he wants to. Now, All Japan Pro Wrestling, he has a run there for 4 years and then moves on to New Japan Pro Wrestling and begins the run that we kind of know him as today and probably most associate with him today. He's got the shaved head with the different patterns shaved into it. At one point, he has a spider pattern shaved into it. But his signature haircut begins in All Japan Pro Wrestling. By the time he gets to New Japan Pro Wrestling, he's a well-rounded main eventer who's wrestled everyone on the King's Road circuit. He is well-known. His attitude is well-known. His respect is well-known. And he comes to New Japan Pro Wrestling, and the first person he attacks is Satoshi Kojima. And he takes over Kojima-gun, which becomes Suzuki-gun. And the Minoru Suzuki we know and fear today is born. So, Chelsea, what are your thoughts on Minoru Suzuki's New Japan Pro Wrestling run from 2010 to now. I know you've seen a lot more of the later stuff, and you've probably seen bits and pieces. What do you feel his character has become, and what do you feel Suzuki Gun has become?
So, it's really interesting because I feel like without having all the prior knowledge of his career, watching him in New Japan Pro Wrestling, he still just always comes across as so legitimate. Like, there's never any moment where you question his authenticity. You know what I mean? Even when you're watching, like, as a hardcore smark who watches a lot of wrestling and tweets about it all the time, it's really hard, I think, to suspend the part of your brain that's always thinking about, well, how does this play out in real life? But Minoru Suzuki is that character actor who I forget who he is underneath the character. I almost never think about that when I watch him wrestle. That's true from the stuff I've watched from the early 2000s where he's in All Japan. It's true with the stuff that I've seen him in New Japan. It's true the stuff I've seen him in doing New Japan now. Also, I love Suzuki Gun as a stable now, set up and established really well, that you have these guys who are teammates sort of formed around the things they have in common with him. Does that make sense? Like,
yeah.
Zack Sabre Jr. is such a perfect person to help continue whatever the legacy of that stable is supposed to be, because he's such a brilliant submission wrestler. And like Minoru Suzuki, he is just relentless. Like, he's not scary, but he's determined. And his determination makes him willing to do terrible things. You know, it's really fun to watch. I think Minoru Suzuki is a guy you can book an entire group of other guys around successfully. And it makes those other guys more interesting. It elevates them. And it gives him something to do where, I mean, he can just stand there and be like, I'm Minoru Suzuki, and I'm not even really a part of this match for more than a few minutes. But you fear me. And these are my guys who will do my bidding. You know, it's just, I love that. Like, a lot of times wrestling stables that are built around one person or two people, a lot of times it just kind of falls apart. Or if it doesn't fall apart, it stays together, but not because the audience cares.
Yeah.
And I've never seen, I mean, there is no New Japan show I've ever seen where Minoru Suzuki comes out and that theme song, which is just so incredible, hits, and the audience doesn't just like light up. Like, people are always excited to see him, and they're excited to see what he's gonna do next, you know. And when he says, like, Zack Sabre Jr. has joined Suzuki Gun, and we are now going to conquer the world, and we're gonna take all the titles, and we're the best, I just believe him. I'm like, well, clearly those things are gonna happen now. I wonder what everybody else is gonna do.
Chelsea, can you just move your microphone away from your mouth slightly?
Oh, I'm sorry. Is that okay?
That's better, yep.
Where was I? Yeah, I don't know. I think he's one of the most successful characters they have. And certainly, for a guy his age to be getting in the ring and doing some of the stuff he does now, I mean, I've seen him do matches with chair shots in them, and where his cardio has to be on point with guys who are half his age. And, you know, he just runs around terrifying everybody. And it never feels like he's out of place. It never feels like, unfortunately, sometimes with the third generation guys, you do get those matches where you're sort of like, all right, you were really amazing at one time, and I still respect you, but I don't necessarily want to watch you wrestle that younger guy because it's not that interesting to me. I never feel that way about Minoru Suzuki, ever. Like, if he's there, I'm fully invested in what he's doing.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I mean, like, I love Tanahashi and Kojima and Iizuka and Nagata, and God bless them for what they've done for the pro wrestling business. But they're not vital components to what New Japan Pro Wrestling can do. You can ship Nagata off to All Japan for 3 months, and it won't affect what you're doing.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm not knocking Yuji for what he does, because he's absolutely astounding. He's still astounding now, you know, and one day we should do a special on him because he's done amazing stuff. But Minoru Suzuki is an enigma of a character that really draws you into what that show is about. You want to know what that guy's doing next, you know. Marcus, yes. What are your thoughts on the character of Minoru Suzuki now in comparison to back then? Kind of asked you this question before, but thinking about what you see now in the ring, where do you think Minoru's gone? Where do you think he could go?
I guess the sky's the limit. You know, I don't know where he can go from here, because it seems like he really is on this perfect, train of momentum right now. And I think, like I said before, you know, that foundation laid, you know, with just everywhere he's been and everything that he's done, you know, the build up that arsenal and kind of like a revolver. Going back to your gunslinger reference, talking about those two guys who are masters of the shooting, won't take their eyes off each other. Very, very reminiscent of that shoot style. That's how you have to be. But with Minoru now, like I said, because of that foundation he had, he was never not legitimate, and you knew what he could do in the ring. So, you know, it created such a wide berth for him to be able to evolve his character to what it is now. And a lot of times, he's so good at his character work that he kind of comes off as that cantankerous old man in a neighborhood that will literally shoot you if you step on his lawn. But instead of waiting for you to step on his lawn, he comes to you a street over and just beat you up before you even get a chance to get on the street. And very violent in that way. But, you know, with Minoru, is just it's incredible. And, you know, just piggybacking again off what Chelsea said, he just has this aura about him. Like, and you know, he's kind of like, you know, if anybody's familiar with the Fast and Furious movies, you know, they talk about you never, when you watch those movies, you never don't think that Dominic Toretto isn't the leader of that group. You know, and even in the movies, I think somebody said, you know, Dominic, you know, which is his name, they say he's like gravity. He pulls people into his orbit. I think that's very much what Minoru is. You know, you look at that group, and a lot of times, like Chelsea said, you put somebody center around one guy, sometimes he can get lost in translation, or, you know, sometimes somebody in the group can stand out so much that it almost seems like they should be the leader. And credit to, you know, Chaos and L.I.J. and Bullet Club, you know, but, you know, with Suzuki Gun, there's never a question, you know, in that pack of wolves who the alpha is.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
From the theme song to, you know, just them doing the entrance as a group, and those guys coming down the ramp, and then you just see Suzuki come out last and just go through all of them. Like, he walked through all of them, you know, with that towel and just that menacing grimace. And, you know, even somebody, like I said, I wasn't too familiar with the being extensive about his career, but just if you turn on a New Japan show for the first time today, you know, and you watch that entrance, you're going to know he's the leader of that group. You're going to, you know, even if you've never seen anything, you're going to be interested in what that guy has, because he has just such a legitimate aura about himself that he's going to intrigue you. Now, obviously, he's going to go from 0 to 100 really quick and kind of, you know, go off the rails from there. But, you know, Suzuki is, like you said, he's an enigma, and he's a one-of-a-kind guy. And just, you know, we're not going to really see too many guys like him again. He's very much in the realm of an Undertaker. There's just an aura about that guy that you just cannot recreate. You cannot, you know, almost put it into words. It's just, you know, something.
He has no equal. There's nobody you can, like, swap him out with who is, like, exactly, who replaces his energy exactly.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing as well, I mean, just to round off his kind of history, he does have that 2-year stint in Noah. He wins the GHC Heavyweight Championship. But as far as his evolution, it's no real different. He has some fantastic matches with Naomichi Marufuji, which you should go watch. Though it starts to be a bit of a grind on the draw of Noah. And when they finally leave Noah after Noah is bought out, and the end comes to the New Japan Noah agreement, he heads back to New Japan Pro Wrestling, and he wins the Intercontinental Championship, which we've just seen. He just lost it to Tetsuya Naito. But the one thing I did want to talk about to round this episode off is his love of pro wrestling generally. You know, a lot of the shoot guys, I mean, if you listen to Josh Barnett, whose wrestling I do adore, you know, he's the kind of wrestler I grew up on, but he has a very set way of understanding how pro wrestling works, and he wants wrestling to be done a certain way, to be appreciated a certain way. And that's not to say he's against running the ropes and he's against angles and one thing or another, but he wants it to be kind of in a shoot style. And he can still make that entertaining, he can still make that a great match. But Minoru Suzuki, despite having a very similar background, loves Joshi, adores Joshi. he's really good friends with Mika Satomura and Aja Kong. And he goes and
tags. Didn't you say he's part-time at New Japan Pro only so he can still have tag matches with Aja Kong for their promotion?
Yeah, I'm not sure that that's actually like the rules, but he is a freelancer. He's not contracted to New Japan Pro Wrestling. He can wrestle for anyone he wants in Japan, so long as it isn't direct competition. So,
what a badass.
Yeah. So he goes off and he tags with Young Kasai and Aja Kong because they're really good mates. So like Young Kasai from Freedom's the like completely insane aerial hardcore wrestler, really good mates with him, likes him a lot.
Of course he and Aja Kong are like, of course the two most terrifying people in the universe are best friends. Like, yeah. That's hilarious.
And Mika Satomura is good friends with Minoru Suzuki as well. You know, they do photo shoots together. They tagged together against Naomichi Marufuji and Kana, who become Asuka, in possibly the best intergender tag match you will ever see. And Mako got mad with Minori for kicking Kana too hard.
It's so great. It's so, like, I can't... That match, I love that match so much that I can't actually watch it without, like, covering my face because I get so emotional. Like, it's such a good tag match.
It is. It is just a brilliant, brilliant wrestling match. And Marufuji and Suzuki were at the height of their feud, and Kana and Satomura were at the height of their feud. And it's the best four wrestlers in that environment to have that match with. And they're all such great storytellers. And watching Kana trying to take Marufuji's chops is just... brutal but beautiful at the same time. But you know, this is the thing with Minoru Suzuki. He does love all of wrestling, all of it, for all of its faults. Whether it's silly wrestling, he'll go and play baseball into the Tokyo Dome with Mako Satomura for DDT because he wants to, and who's going to argue with him? You know, this is the thing that is like makes me laugh when you see things people like Jim Cornette going on about, all this silly stuff is ruining wrestling. And it's like, Minoru Suzuki is still the scariest motherfucker on the planet, and he does it, so why can't everyone else?
Yeah.
It is like, who's going to argue with him? He's not lost any of his realism, he's not lost any of his scariness, just because he did a couple of matches for DDT and ran somebody over with a bike. That hasn't changed the fact he is still a badass, has it?
No, not at all.
Not at all. When I see a lot of those young boys that be by the ring that kind of provide tiles and whatever, I don't see why they don't just scatter immediately when he comes out. I literally say like quick prayers anytime I watch a New Japan show because it's just it's brutal. But I don't get following any type of Jim Cornette logic at this point. It's just like forcing yourself to have a brain for it. But there's no silliness. Like I said, at this stage in his career, he has that creative license because he is one of the most legitimate guys ever.
Yes.
And, you know he can do that because, you know, he can, you know, go through all that stuff and then come right back and take you down and take you right back to a pancrase match if he so desires. And then there's nothing you're going to be able to do about it because you're going to be sitting up there like Josh Barnett wondering, how in the hell did he break my guard? Before you know it, the match is going to be over.
Did you guys watch his match with Mio Shirai?
I've seen it, yes.
From Pro Wrestling Wave. I love that match because you can tell, even though the storyline in that is that he's big and scary and she can't get, you know, it takes her forever in that match to be able to successfully land a blow on him that generates any kind of impact. Like, she will punch him as hard as she can and it barely does anything, and then he will just chop her in the chest and knock her down. And it becomes comedic instead of really, really scary after a certain point, even though neither of them really breaks character. And I love that match so much. I was just enchanted watching it because you can tell that they're both having a really good time. I don't know even how I know that. You can just tell. Like, I don't know. I was thinking about it, James, because you were talking about how much he loves pro wrestling. And watching that, I was like, you know, I totally believe that. He doesn't think of himself as above any of it. You know, he wants to make cool art and considers the art form more important than any particular, like, prideful feelings he might have about it. Like, it was really funny watching him toss a 90-pound soaking wet Japanese girl who is, you know, superb wrestling technician. Mio Shirai was amazing. Just like, you know, toss her around like she weighed absolutely nothing. And then when she finally lands a blow on him, the entire audience just gasps in unison.
Yeah. So it was absolutely brilliant. And that match was for the GHC Heavyweight Championship because Minoru put it on the line because it was Mio's last tour. She's the only female to challenge for the GHC Heavyweight Championship ever.
That's wonderful.
And he didn't tell, he didn't, it wasn't advertised as that. He went to the referee and the ring announcer and said, this is for the GHC Heavyweight Championship. Because he's that cool.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yes, it really, really is. Marcus, what are your final thoughts on Minoru Suzuki?
I just think he's an all-around, really just an all-around legend, you know, from everything that he does, both in-ring and then character-wise. I mean, he already has the grimace on his face coming out the towel. there's already a perception in my mind watching wrestling all these years, and immediately when I see somebody without knee pads, you're thinking two things. This guy's either, you know, really doesn't really know what he's doing and is kind of dumb for not wearing knee pads, or this SOB is a different level of tough that whoever he's in the ring with is not ready for. And that's Minoru Suzuki. And just the guys, like we talked about, he's just a once-in-a-lifetime guy. He almost comes off as like a comic book villain almost, the way he's presented. But at the end of the day, you know, he truly is, one of the best things that, you know, we've seen in this business in some time, and we're never going to see anything like it again. But again, you know, that's kind of what you want. You want somebody to stand out like a Minoru Suzuki. It's just that it's so rare that you find somebody that great in the ring and has that great of a character that we get it in unison. So, I'm just glad to know more about him.
Chelsea, what are your thoughts on Minoru?
I mean, he'll always be in the conversation for greatest of all time. And he'll also, his theme song will always be in the conversation for greatest of all time because it is the best. If you can hear Kaze Ninare without singing along with it, even if you don't know what it means, I don't know what to tell you. You should give up being a wrestling fan because it's not for you.
Well, there is one person that scares Minoru Suzuki, and that's Ayumi Nakamura, who sings Kaze Ninare, because when he became a wrestler, he heard that song, and he always wanted that song as his theme tune. And when he finally got to meet her, he has to speak in the very posh, formal version of Japanese. He can't speak in his normal Japanese to her because he has that much respect for her.
He talks to her like she's a goddess.
Yes.
Yeah. Which, I mean, to be fair, she does deserve. She's had an incredible career. And that's kind of awesome that he acknowledges that.
It is indeed. So we would like to say thank you to Minoru Suzuki for all the things you have given us and given the pro wrestling industry and the MMA industry in Japan and in North America. You are absolutely amazing. And I don't think you've got the worst personality in the world, but, you know, you show it sometimes.
Yeah.
The young boys of the New Japan Dojo wouldn't agree with me.
Yeah. Yo, anybody that's ever been in within 5 feet of Lance Hoyt.
All right, then. Thank you very much for listening to Beginner's Guide to Japanese Wrestling. My name is James Trupany. I would like to thank my guest for today, Mr. Marcus Green. You can find him at Paradox Kid on Twitter. Thank you, sir.
Yes, sir. Always a pleasure.
And you can find Miss Chelsea Spollen at shoulders_up, where she usually talks about wrestling. You can find her at Chelsea Comics as well. Thank you very much for your time, ma'am.
Thanks for having me.
And you can find me, James Trupany, at Sheriff Lone Star on Twitter, and the show at Trupany Show on Twitter. You can find us on Facebook, The Trupany Show, and on Patreon, The Trupany Show, where you can keep the show free forever for everyone. Thank you very much for listening today. We'll be back soon. Take care, and keep watching Minoru Suzuki, because he probably won't be around for another 30 years. But for now, it's him and the Rainmaker at his 30th anniversary show. Take care. Bye.
Suzuki Minoru, debut 25周年にあたるこの1年を祝福するかのように、入場テーマ曲を作った中村あゆみさんが風になれを歌います。限りなく切ない明日の
中学卒業と同時にプロレスラーになると決めたという鈴木みのる。